morning. You're listening to Conversations with Lulu. I'm Lulu Ghazan, an entrepreneur living in Dubai, an investor, a mother, and your host. Today's episode is supported by Primal Alignment. So Primal Alignment is a platform dedicated to people who want to get fit and stay fit. So my friend, Coach Frankie, who's a former Green Beret and a former instructor of the British Commandos training wing, is going to change your life. All you need to do is to register to the online program by visiting primalalignment.net. It's not a personal training session. It's more of a motivation session. So check it out. I'm sure you're going to love it. My guest today is the super genuine, absolutely lovely Sonia Waymuller. She's the co-founder of Venture Souq, which is a Dubai-based investment platform that invests in global tech startups. She's previously had a career in media and technology, having worked with Microsoft and Viacom. Sonia sits on several boards. She's a real badass. You can read her extensive bio in the show notes. Sonia, it's so good to have you here with me.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. You're really honest. I like that. It's very refreshing.
Thank you. I'll need more honesty in life.
We do. And I really love what you guys do at Venture Souq. I've been hearing about Venture Souq for a while. I recently met one of your partners and he told me all about it. I mean, you essentially give an opportunity for people with some extra cash, let's say, to invest in tech startups. And usually this opportunity is only available to people that are very well connected in the space or super rich people, right, that have money to put in funds. How was this born? And how is it also now with COVID? Are you still investing actively?
Yeah, I mean, we started 7 years ago now, right? So the venture capital landscape in this region was incredibly different. It's grown so much over the last years. And so when we started, it was four of us friends. We just started as an informal kind of investor club, you know, side hustle from our day jobs. We started angel investing together. And what we found was that there were actually a lot of people like us in their late 20s and their 30s who wanted to invest in early stage technology businesses, but didn't feel like they had the platform to do so or didn't feel comfortable doing so because it felt like they couldn't make an informed decision. And so we started hosting pitch nights. We invite three entrepreneurs we found interesting. And then it just grew organically. Our friends started inviting their friends. And then fast forward 7 years, and we've probably grown into the largest syndicate now in the Gulf. So we have over 1,000 angel investors in our network.
That's amazing. And are they like, what's the typical profile of an investor? Do you have men and women?
Yeah. So we have about 25% women, actually.
Okay.
And our minimum check size is $10,000. The whole ethos behind Venture Souq when we started is that we wanted to democratize access to good deal flow, exactly what you said. And so so that's why we made our minimum somewhat accessible. So the target demo is basically people like us, right? Like young professionals, don't have $500,000 to put in a company, but maybe have 15,000, 20,000. And each of them can add value in more ways than just a financial check. They can add strategic value based on each person's own professional trajectory.
And can anyone join the network? I mean, provided you can spend $10,000 or $15,000 a year on investing, is there any other criteria?
No, I mean, there's no membership fee. You literally just send any of us an email if you meet us and we add you to the distribution list. I think what we're becoming better at is understanding what each investor wants. So typically I'll know that Lulu, for example, is interested specifically in regional deals and maybe specifically in the e-commerce space. Let's just say it's that, right? So we don't blast emails out to people with all the opportunities, right? I will only send Lulu the deals that actually fit her mandate. So there's no membership fee. Ahlan wa sahlan, everyone can join. And it is meant to be a community. It's a community of investors and of like-minded folks, essentially.
And how's it been now with COVID? Are you still actively investing?
Yeah, still actively investing. Listen, I think COVID's difficult for a lot of entrepreneurs. I think it is going to be survival of the fittest. I think what's interesting about this period is that most VCs tend to focus on scalability, right? So scalability tends to be the buzzword. How scalable is this business? Is the question that most entrepreneurs get from VCs. And for us now, it's not been a bit scaling up. It's like, how how good is this company at scaling down, right? And so what how agile is it? So how agile is it to actually cut costs? Because it's going to be a difficult fundraising environment for many. And so, you know, those companies that have just fundraised are probably in a good spot because they have enough runway for the next at least 12 months, hopefully, if not 24. The ones who haven't fundraised recently are the ones that have to tighten their belt right now. So whether it be laying people off, whether it be cutting costs, salary cuts, marketing, obviously, reductions, etc. There's all these different ways. But I mean, it's kind of the name of the game now, unfortunately.
Are people more reluctant now to invest? Investors in general? Are they becoming more picky about certain sectors, for instance? We had an investment that we looked at recently with my small network, Kickstart Ventures, and we had something which we felt it wasn't an industry that's not going to do well, obviously, and we're starting to look at different types of industries and trying to figure out, okay, what are the industries that are going to thrive, basically?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely have, I mean, the ones that are going to thrive right now are obviously like last mile delivery services and ed tech and health tech. And so have we seen... we've seen a shift, I would say, especially at the beginning, like in March, April. I think that was also the time of uncertainty where people were like, what is happening? Stock market, you know, oil prices, like the whole shebang. It was kind of like, it was a triple black swan, essentially, right? So so there was, I think, a pause from some people who were like, you know what, let me just ride this out for a bit and see if you know, where I stand, you know, in the next 2 months. Now we're starting to see people kind of coming back. I think people have more clarity. They understand that this is the new reality and, you know, just need to live with it now. And then, you know, we launched, you know this, but we launched also our Conscious Collective at the same time. So Conscious Collective is a platform that I personally been wanting to do for a long time, but we launched it not because of COVID, but just, you know, synchronicity. It just happened that it was around the same time. And it's a platform that is a community of like-minded and mission-driven investors from the region, both individual investors and family offices, who want to give their money more purpose and more impact. So we're investing right now in companies that are, and entrepreneurs that are harnessing the power of technology to actually optimize societal good, financial inclusion, environmental good, etc. And the purpose of that is to show that you can invest in companies that are scalable and tech enabled, and you can get a financial return. But the legacy that these companies have is a long-term one. And so this is something, again, that we just launched, and we just made our first investment last month.
And where do you draw the line between like a traditional tech business, which could also claim that they are, you know, tackling a societal issue, right?
I think it depends on like what the target demographic is for the company, right? If it's an ed tech company that's targeting like a bunch of affluent kids, that's probably not something that we would look at, right? They really need to fill a gap, especially for the underserved, right? If you're an ed tech platform and you're looking to actually democratize learning, that's something that resonates with me a lot more than I've come up with another ed tech platform to make it easier for affluent 10-year-olds to, you know, learn online. This is because I come from a consulting background, like a strategy background. I like to have like check boxes. And my biggest struggle when I was thinking about building Conscious Collective last year under the Venture Souk umbrella was, all right, I know that I want the founders to demonstrate integrity and kind of a strong moral compass and values. What does that mean, right? Because that's somewhat subjective when you think about it, right? And so I spent like a couple of months like being like, what does this mean? Like, how can I translate that into like a checkbox or a rating system, etc.? And I actually met with Mudassar and like a bunch of other ex-McKinsey people.
So
and
Mudassar
I was like, help
the,
me.
As the CEO
founder of Kareem.
Yeah.
And so, and all of that, they were like, Sonia, you're overthinking this. And I think it's basically because of the consulting kind of brainwashing that I had, right? You know, you can't define everything necessarily. And so, so all the deals that we look at for Conscious Collective go through our rating system. So we have a proprietary internal kind of rating system that we have at Venture Souk that every deal that comes across our desk is fed through. Obviously the Conscious Collective one has added columns and added ratings to it because of the impact measurement angle. And then the ones that meet the threshold, we get a deeper dive from a diligence standpoint, and then again, the top like two or three will end up at the IC. But from a pipeline standpoint, back to your question, no, we have a pipeline of 60 companies that we've built over the last 3 months.
Locally, regionally, or internationally?
Our remit is basically pre-Series A, Series A, global.
So can you clarify what that means? Just what's a pre-Series A and Series A?
So for our purposes, we wouldn't invest in a company that has an like a minimum viable product, like an MVP, and doesn't have any traction, and they're still testing stuff out, etc. That's just too early for.
And by traction, you mean revenue, or what do you mean exactly?
Yeah, there has to be some proof of concept, right? That this is demonstrating a need, and that there's demand for this product specifically. The other things that we look at, obviously, aside from the traction, is who are the other investors, right? Because we wouldn't lead any of the rounds because our check sizes are pretty small. But if there's a well-known investor who has experience in the specific sector, if it's environmental technology, for example, that would be taken into account as well. And in fact, we would probably speak with that investor as well about the investment. Like any VC, you look at team, you look at product, and then you look at obviously what the competitive landscape is like. But the team, obviously, at this stage is what's the most important, right? Because you can have the greatest idea in a mediocre team, and the idea is not going to go anywhere. You've heard this before, right? But you can have interesting idea, but an amazing team, and then that'll skyrocket most likely.
I think an amazing team can maybe even trump the idea. We invested in a company recently that's in the B2B travel space. And obviously B2B travel is now, non-existent. So, and they're actually pivoting, they're working on new ideas, and that's what strong founders do. I love your point about like a checklist, a founder checklist. I would be interested to know what you come up with. I tell you why. We all have our biases, right? So sometimes, and unconscious biases. So sometimes maybe you might have certain criteria in mind, but you meet someone and you like them, for example, and you waver on several of these criteria, but you might have been reading like the wrong signals.
But I think it goes a deeper level than that even, right? Because typically the first thing we look at, right, as investors is like, okay, like what experience does the founder have? Do they have relevant experience? Where did they go to school? Did they start a business before? Did it fail? Did it succeed, etc.? But I actually think like with Conscious Collective, we like to go kind of one further step, which is actually get to know the founder as a human being, right? Like I think when I look even for us as Venture Soup, I'm sure the same with you. It's like you have kind of these initial conversations with founders, get a feel for them and you know, whether you get along, and because this is a marriage ultimately, right? If you're investing in a company. But I think my learning, at least for Conscious Collective, is actually getting to know the founder at a deeper level and understanding where this company fits in their own journey. Because when I look back at some of the companies even that we've invested to as Venture Souk, some of the ones that have struggled are ones that were led by founders that were still trying to find themselves, you know? And sometimes the idea might be great and the founder has a great background, but maybe the timing is not right. You know, maybe the timing is not right for that founder to start this business for whatever reason. Right?
Do you say that to potential founders?
I've said that to this one that I have that I'm talking about in my mind right now. Yeah, I've had that conversation with him.
Okay.
And he ended up leaving the business actually to go find himself, you know, and then he passed on the torch to another to his co-founder essentially, and that's important because we're all kind of on this journey of self-awareness and trying to kind of better understand ourselves, right? And you know, they say that for relationships even, right? Even like, you know, you should know yourself before you get into a relationship or marry someone else, right? It's important that you know what you want before you get into a relationship with someone else. And I think it's the same in this case as well, right? You want to make sure that the founder is self-aware enough, and that takes work. Self-awareness doesn't just happen like this. I mean, both you and I know that, like we're still discovering
time.
Things.
It takes time.
Yeah, it does take time. And you're going to evolve as a human being as well, right?
That's, by the way, one of my things when you have all of these programs that try to encourage university students to become entrepreneurs. And like to me, I'm thinking, okay, I started Nebbish when I was 30. And still I feel like I was relatively young, you know, to have that responsibility.
Yeah.
And now I'm 39 and like I'm a different person almost.
Yeah.
So try to think like you're 24 years old, 23 years old. I mean, what do you think? Do you think it's a good idea to encourage people straight out of university to become entrepreneurs?
No, but like I mentor quite a few high school kids even who are applying to college, and I've told them the same thing. Just like I tell to actually that my mentees who are in university, like my NYU Abu Dhabi, for example, interns. I always say like to the high school students, I say, go with an open mind. When I went for my undergrad to the US, I thought I was going to major in econ because I did my French baccalaureate in econ in Paris, right? So I was like, oh, well, this makes sense, right? Got there, but then I took all these amazing that's the beauty of the liberal arts education in the US, I have to say. It's like you take all these amazing classes and you only have to decide what you're going to focus on by the end of your second year of university. And I ended up, you know, thinking I was going to major in art history, thinking I was going to major in sociology, and then I ended up majoring in politics, right? And so what I say is that, and that's why I don't believe in five-year plans. I think five-year plans are maybe somewhat useful kind of to have kind of goals, maybe kind of directionally. Yeah, directionally, right? But I definitely have never been the type of chick who's like, okay, like 5 years from now, I want to be, you know, partner at a venture capital firm, or I want to be, you know, VP at McKinsey or whatever, right? Like I've never, I think it's important to have an idea maybe of where you want to head, but you also need to be open, right? Like life throws you all kinds of different things. And if you're not open to accepting that, you're going to miss out on a lot. And that's what I tell these little ducklings of mine is keep an open mind, even the ones that are in university, like, you know, yes, you think you want to go into consulting because that's what everyone around you is doing, right?
Because it makes money.
Maybe, yeah, but, you know, open up, right? So that's why we have some NYU interns who definitely didn't fit the bill of, you know, econ majors or whatever. But, you know, they're interested in the space. They're learning a lot. They're actually adding a lot of value to us as well, right? Because they come from a different background and different perspective.
I think maybe instead of having a five-year plan, what would be really good is to have a set of values maybe that kind of drive you. You know, so maybe you would say, okay, I'm going to be open and honest in all my interaction, or I'm going to be helpful, or a certain set of values, maybe that kind of be your guiding principles versus saying like in 5 years, I want to be this. Would you agree?
No, I agree. And I also think that I think the educational system needs to shift as well, which is why it's going to be interesting to see what happens now, right? That we're seeing a bit of a shift happening to online. Because I think when I was in university, for example, you know, we had everyone from like the CIA to McKinsey to Goldman Sachs all recruiting on our campus, right? So that's what you're surrounded by. You don't see the Lulus and the Sonias on campus recruiting for jobs, right? You kind of see these mainstream
big
players essentially. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think in retrospect, I wish I had had a Lulu, for example, come to my school and have this honest discussion about, I think maybe it's happening now. To be fair, like I'm not that young. So, I mean, I did graduate 15 years ago.
Not much. I'm mentoring university students even today. And I still see this, you know, you have Emirati students that want to join the government because, you know, it's not a lot of hours and they get paid really well and stuff like that. So it's very difficult to, and I'm sure, you know, everybody else would probably want to work for those big companies versus working for like a smaller company and stuff. So it's still there. And there's a lot of work to be done. And maybe what we need to do when we mentor high school students and university students is maybe talk to them about the entrepreneurial mindset. And maybe not necessarily them going out and launching startups, but how to think maybe like entrepreneurs.
And also just not to overthink, I think. Because I think there's a lot of pressure when you're in school. You're getting pressure from the school and you're getting pressure from your families. Especially there's a cultural angle to this as well, right? When you come from the East, whether it be from the Middle East or whether it be from, you know, South Asia, it's the same thing, right? It's like, oh, you should be a doctor. You should be an engineer. You should be at this. You should be at that, right? But then that's why you kind of have to also open up your networks and meet different kinds of people from different walks of life so that you also kind of get to know what resonates with you specifically.
You call yourself a Frindian.
I am definitely a Frindian, and it's my nickname. I'm called Frindy. My Instagram, it's Frindy.
So what's a Frindian?
A Frindian is basically because I'm half French, half Indian. So so that's why I was speaking to a friend yesterday who's Scottish Emirati, and I was like, "What are you?" And I'm like, "Scotterati." So yeah, I'm bicultural, and I'm also a third culture kid.
So how did that work? A French, like the French are like reserved, quiet, right? Kind of.
I don't know about that.
No?
I mean,
okay.
We're not Scandinavian.
But like Indians are, you know, they're lively, they're bubbly. So how did this match work?
It worked. I mean, listen, until my dad passed away, like my parents were like super lovey-dovey, like holding hands and like, you know, embarrassingly for me and, you know. No, I think, you know, it doesn't work all the time for sure. I think, you know, it's like almost like a team, even, you know, a startup team. It's like complementary skill sets and complementary personalities almost, right? So you want to make sure with anyone in your life, again, whether it be a partner or a colleague, that you're bringing out the best in the other person, right? And I think they brought the best out of each other. Like my dad was from a conservative French family and my mom kind of brought up this fun side to him. And then my mom is kind of like, you know, as a 65-year-old version of me. And so, you know, he reined her in maybe a little bit. And then together it kind of worked. They met midway.
Very, very nice. You had mentioned that they also come from different religions, right?
Yeah, it was religious as well. So my mom comes from a Muslim Indian family. My dad very French Catholic. So actually, I was raised Catholic, and my sister was raised Muslim. So I'm baptized, confirmed, and the whole shebang. And I'm now agnostic and spiritual, by the way. But I went to a Jesuit high school. Like, I did the whole, you know. And I think it's beautiful. We need more of this.
But why was someone raised Christian or Muslim? Are you like half sisters or?
Yes, my mom. So yeah, my mom's first marriage, basically, when she was 18, the young arranged marriage. But I consider her my full sister. We're very, very different. We look very different, and we have completely opposite personalities. My sister's a poet, so she's the intellectual one. Actually, yeah, she's the intellectual one.
And what about you?
I'm just the street smart one.
You're the street smart one. Okay, well, that's a good, that works as well.
Yeah, complimentary.
What was important to them that they kind of like passed on to you?
Both families, I think, but especially I think maybe more like my mom's family, maybe especially, but like definitely that if you can be helpful to people, you know? And I think that that's something that I've held close to my heart since I was a kid, essentially. And I think that's probably actually one of the first things that people would say if you were to ask them to describe me is like, well, Sonia's super helpful, or she's a connector, or some people have called me a human router because I'll just automatically connect people. No expectations, but just like if I'm having conversation with you and I'm like, oh, Lulu mentioned this, I should introduce her to so-and-so. And then I just make the connections. That's my way, I guess, of contributing to someone's journey, where I feel like I'm good at matching, and hopefully something productive and positive comes out of that encounter.
That's a huge skill to have, right? Also, I
mean, you know what I've noticed, it's not something that people do. I don't know why. I feel like a lot of people are very territorial about their relationships, you know, and I find that's a pity because
some people benefit financially from their relationship,
and then some people obviously attach a commission or whatever, which I would not do. But which is unfortunate because like if you feel strongly that two people should meet, you should just facilitate that and let them, and something beautiful might come out of that meeting. Like,
have you been helpful at all and then you regretted it, or you felt that maybe the people weren't worthy of your help or something? Has it ever backfired?
Not that I know of, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't, right? It's just that it hasn't come back to me that it backfired, maybe. I mean, obviously there are conversations that I was like, oh, like, thanks for introducing me. You know, I had a good conversation. It doesn't go anywhere, right? But whatever, you never know. Again, I believe in synchronicity in life, and it might not be useful for you to have to kind of engage with this person right now. But maybe 2 years from now, you're on a different path and you're like, oh, wow, I should reconnect with Lulu, you know?
I agree with you fully.
Yeah.
Never burn a bridge, actually. I think that's very important, and always be helpful if you can.
And that's why I think it's important to always have conversations. And even with entrepreneurs, and this is an advice to the entrepreneurs who are actually watching this. If someone, like if you ever encounter me and I say, oh, you should meet so-and-so, just send me a thank you, at least, you know? Because that's happened a lot, where you send a lot of intros and people are not appreciative or don't recognize it, and I actually find that's very bad behavior. I'm not expecting anything in return, but a simple thank you is I think nice. Don't just expect that your investors or your people who are looking at your business will just automatically open up their doors. Not everyone does, so if they do, be grateful for that, you know, and just say thank you. Like, you didn't need to go out of your way. I appreciate it.
You're very helpful also on a personal level. I know last time you and I spoke, you told me about Sisu.
Yes.
Where is Sisu? Me. She's behind you. Sisu is a rescued, disabled cat.
Yes. I found her on the road here in Dubai. She was crawl at night. So she was crawling with the strength of her two front legs, dragging her back. Like, she'd been hit by a car, I think. And then I drove by, and because it was dark, so I was like, okay, weird. So I just, you know, I let her pass without knowing what was happening. And then I thought about it. I was like, something's off. So I drove back, parked the car, and then realized that she actually couldn't move her back legs. And so then I didn't know what to do. I was in shock. So I just sat next to her on the road, and I started singing Bob Marley to her to calm myself down, but also to calm, you know, everything's going to be all right. And then that's when I saw the beauty of Dubai's, like, you know, kind of grassroots community when it comes to animal rescue. I'm part of this Facebook group. I posted, I was like, help, I'm here, I don't know what to do. And then within half an hour, someone showed up with a cat carrier and was like, Sonia, take her to this vet that's open at 9 p.m etc. And then the vet said, like, she's not going to walk again, spinal injury, put her down. And I was like, I don't feel like I want to do that. And so she's not in pain, she zooms around, and I think she's healing me as much as I'm healing her. Little cat of determination. You should get a pet for your kids, huh?
I have a cat and a dog.
Oh!
Yeah, we've had a dog. He's almost 11. And we have a stray cat that adopted us like 2 years ago. And I can't get rid of her. So
does she come inside as well?
Yeah, so now she comes inside and stuff. Yeah,
Do you have a cat flap?
I have a dog flap, which the cat figured out how to use.
So what does Sisu mean? So Sisu, when you get to the vet here, they ask you for the patient's name, right? And I was like, patient's names. And I was thinking like Greek goddess names, like strong names. I wanted a strong name, right? Then I came across this word called Sisu in Finnish. And it basically means extreme courage in the face of extraordinary adversity. Like if you Google Sisu, there's books written on becoming or finding your Sisu and all this stuff. And it's actually like it's a philosophy of life in Finland, which I found fascinating. People name their boat Sisu. My friend actually uses the word Sisu, American friend, by the way, to define kind of what entrepreneurs need to succeed.
Wow.
Because it's resilience and it's grit, you know. Yeah, so it's a short, cute name as well, but it's also just a meaningful name.
She's lucky to have found you, that's for sure.
Yes, they say cats find you, so she definitely found the right human.
they do. You are a softie after all. I mean,
I have a soft heart amidst the strong appearance sometimes.
Yeah, people think you're strong.
I think a lot of us people have this image of strength, right? Like if you look at a lot of the female founders in our ecosystem, Sarah Appleton, Amreen Musa, you, me, like I think everyone probably thinks we have it all figured out, right? And we don't. Like, I mean, I don't think any of us have it. I mean, I can't speak for Sarah and Amreen, but I mean, or you even, but like, I haven't figured it out. I'm just kind of on my journey and just kind of appreciating the journey that I'm on while keeping an open mind and being receptive to other things that come into my life. So I think it's difficult for women because on the one hand, they feel like they need to portray a certain, especially in this region where it's very image centric. And, you know, you feel like you need to portray a certain image on stage, for example, when you're speaking, when really I think what resonates the most with people who listen or watch you on stage is your authenticity, right? Like sharing kind of the hard milestones that you've had in your life, not just the good ones, because it's more likely than not that most people are going to go through those hard times. So it's a lot more kind of helpful if you actually talk about those hard times. You know, how did you address some of the tough times that you actually encountered in your life?
No, but nobody asks you these questions, though. Like if you, you know, every press article that you read out there, it's always about so-and-so has raised so much money or so-and-so has sold their company.
It puts a lot of pressure on entrepreneurs. And I really feel for the entrepreneurs today, the ones that are struggling because of COVID, because you have this huge amount of pressure. You see all these articles left, right, and center on all these raises and all these like successful founders, like on the front page of all these magazines and stuff. And then you just, you know, how does that make you feel about yourself? You know, and I do think that mental health is something that's not being addressed here, especially within the entrepreneurial community. We have quite a few vocal people who talk about it on their social media, but I don't think there's like, I think we need to be more organized in how we deal with mental health issues. And I think, I hope that that's something that may come out of this period even.
Well, maybe it was something we should have as a group for entrepreneurs in this region that are having problems that want to like just vent and talk about them.
But it's tough because entrepreneurs sometimes don't feel comfortable doing that because they don't want to be seen as weak. I did a session a month ago with an entrepreneur in Bahrain, and it was the most beautiful session. He opened up about so many different topics from spirituality to this culture of shame. You know, he left his cushy job to do this startup. And it was surreal for me because I was like, you know what? In the normal circumstances, I would have never had this conversation with this entrepreneur, right? But all he needed was a listener, you know, an active listener. And for us to be able to have this conversation, I mean, like a Bahraini male entrepreneur opening up to a female expat investor, you know, I think he just needed to be heard and heard by someone who kind of understands, you know, his world. So not a friend or a spouse or, you know, or someone who can't relate to what they're going through. And so this is a conversation I've had with quite a few people around me. I was talking about this yesterday with a friend as well, where it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be. I'm not a trained psychiatrist, by the way, but I empathize because I understand what some of these entrepreneurs are going through. And sometimes if I can help just with a few words or just even listen, I think that's what they need. They just need to get it off their chest. It's like a form of release almost, you know?
I think we need to ask, like, somebody needs to ask the questions as well. And maybe also not label, like, it's not like you're a successful entrepreneur or you're a failure, right? So there's a lot that kind of goes on in the middle. And maybe if we don't put labels and we start asking more exciting questions, you know, the people that are in the media space, instead of like, okay, how much did you raise and what's your expansion plan? But maybe, you know, they have other challenges.
Well, I challenge you to then have a panel of three entrepreneurs who will be willing to be open with you and share some of the challenges that they faced. And then you ask the right questions, exactly what you just said.
I'm also happy, I think, to share my experience as well. Because also, you know, sometimes you hear about these raises, but it doesn't mean that the terms were good to the entrepreneur. So maybe they did raise this $5 million or $10 million, but maybe the terms were very punitive, right? So no one knows the details.
And no one shares. That's the thing. I'm sure you discussed this with Philip as well at Magnet, right? Is that no one's really opening their kimonos. I'm the first one to say that we don't open our kimono either, right? When it comes to our proprietary kind of data on startups and raises, et cetera, right? That's why, you know, research outlets do struggle with this region because people just don't feel comfortable being transparent necessarily.
Maybe for entrepreneurs also, you have a challenge on several ends, right? On the one end, you are compared head to head, let's say, with your corporate friends that have great jobs and, you know, getting their promotions and their bonuses and so on. On the other hand, you have these entrepreneurs raising the funds and, you know, doing really well. And like you're screwed, like you're in the middle and you're like, damn. And I'm sure it happens 90% of the time.
I remember even when I jumped ship on my end from corporate to venture souk, I soundboarded with my mentors. And I guess in my case, I was at a point in my career where I felt like the learning curve was stagnant. And so I felt like this was the right time to do it because I was in my late 20s, didn't have any responsibilities. Still don't have any responsibilities other than my cat. But you know, it was kind of the right time, right place, right time type of scenario. But that said, it's still a major decision to take because you're leaving the comfort of a cushy monthly paycheck towards kind of the unknown, essentially.
So
right?
Why did you do it? Like, I mean, you could have taken another job in a different industry.
I could have very easily done that.
So why start a business?
I think, so my dad passed away 10 years ago pretty suddenly, like as in like died in front of me pretty much at a young age, and he was healthy and stuff. And so I can say this in retrospect because I don't think I processed it in this way when I was 25 when it happened. But in retrospect, I don't think I would have had the courage to actually jump ship had it not been for his passing. Because I think unless you've been through something like that, where either you lose a parent or you lose a close friend, et cetera, you don't really think about your mortality. I mean, you kind of think about it, but like, you know, it's not like front of mind necessarily. And so when he passed away, I kind of had to step up in the family and essentially act as like almost like the older son in a family, you know, and kind of take over kind of the admin stuff and the finances and all that stuff. And obviously be there for my mom, my sister. And so I feel like I matured a lot, like it accelerated my entry into adulthood almost between the ages of 25 onwards, essentially. And so I think it made me a lot more reflective, not at that specific time, but maybe in the years after that, in terms of how I'm spending my time and what I want to do. And I think that's why I ended up feeling motivated, because I was like, you know what, life is short. Like if I don't do this now, who knows what'll happen? And if I hadn't had that kind of mindset because of what happened, I probably would have gone for that other job offer that was cushy, you know? So I do owe it to my dad, I think, for pushing me in a way. He's probably laughing from heaven, by the way, because my dad was in finance and his dream was for me to end up in finance like him. And I resisted. And then now it's kind of come full circle. I'm actually in finance, financing startups. So, so he's probably having a good laugh.
I'm sure he's happy and he's proud. What about your mom? What did she want you to be?
My
mom usually Indians have a plan, right? Like a long-term plan for their kids.
But my mom's own trajectory was a bit different herself, right? Like she got married very early and like, you know, got divorced very early. And then, so she's always been very open. In fact, when I applied for college in the States, I went to quite a conservative high school where in the history of my high school, no one had ever gone to school in the States. You want to go abroad, you go to the UK, you go to Germany, but you don't go to the US. And so so when I was applying for universities, it's actually my mom who was very encouraging of my applying because, you know, even though it's far from Paris and stuff, she was like, you need to find yourself. And the liberal arts kind of education system is a good one to kind of, you know, test stuff out. It's not like you have to apply with a specific major like some of the other educational system in other markets. So my mom also had her own challenges. So she got cancer, breast cancer, when about 26 years ago. Touch wood, she's fine. She's still alive and kicking it and rocking it. I was 9 at the time. And that's what prompted actually the move. We were living in Tokyo at the time to New York for her treatment. And it was quite shocking. I mean, obviously as a 9-year-old, but I don't think I understood what was happening. Like, I didn't know what cancer was. I didn't know what chemo was. I didn't know what any of these things. I could see that my mom looked a bit different. You know, I wasn't mature enough to reflect on what was happening. I was more worried about, oh my God, like, we just moved from Tokyo. I didn't get to say goodbye to my friends, and I have to make new friends in the school in New York now.
But for you not to feel it, like, she must have been quite strong, you know, in fighting it.
I'm sure she did break down. I'm sure there were breakdowns kind of in the background. But obviously, she wouldn't show that to her daughter necessarily, or her daughters necessarily. But back to the earlier point of helping, even after her treatment, she would still go to the hospital where she was treated and sit in the waiting room and just talk to the other patients there, you know, because she felt that, you know, they could empathize, and, you know, she could empathize with their experience, and seeing her having gone through it would give them kind of, you know, a positive outlook on their own treatment.
Again, if you go back, you know, talking also openly about cancer, it wasn't something that people just did, right? People just didn't really share these things. And in general, like, people who are sick, they're usually, it's difficult for them to get, like, the support around them. So it's amazing, like, what she's done.
It's also cultural, I think. Like, I think, again, back to the East, I think that the U.S. speaks very openly about diseases and illnesses, etc. I think here in the East, whether it be the Middle East or Far East, etc., culturally taboo. Actually, even in France, to be honest, like, it's culturally taboo, because I think maybe because it's perceived as a sign of weakness, when really it should be perceived as a sign of strength, because, you know, yes, you're being vulnerable because of what's happening, but, you know, you're also getting through it, you know, so it should be seen as a, and so that's a narrative that needs to change as well, right? And we're seeing this change now, because quite a few women who are well-known, who've had all kinds of illnesses, have been very vocal about it through their social media channels. But that was a different time. Again, this was pre-iPhone, pre-social media,
Great point. I was going to mention social media. So where do you stand on being, like, vocal with the purpose of educating and creating empathy and helping people understand, for example, how to deal with such diseases, or vocal and just basically airing everything out on social media? And
yeah, I mean, I think there's two things in that. Like, one is that I think awareness is very important. And I think that's one thing that social media does well. Most of the time, maybe not all the time, but at least in terms of when it comes to bringing awareness around specific diseases or illnesses or challenges. People airing about it, I personally don't have an issue with it. Like, it's their own journey. And that's the second point, right? It's that people who are going through things like this, health challenges, for example, have their own way of dealing with it. Some people just don't want to talk about it, or they prefer to meditate on it, or, you know, it's a personal journey. Others, it's therapeutic to talk about it. It's therapeutic for them to post pictures of themselves going through their treatments on social media, or their journeys, etc. And I think ultimately, to each their own. Like, I'm not one to judge, etc. I do think when it comes to, so for example, with cancer specifically, I think people, especially people our age, like, you always think, oh, like, so-and-so died of cancer, that's never going to happen to me. Or you watch, like, a movie, and, like, someone has cancer in the movie, and it's like, all right, this is sad. Well, this is never going to happen to me, right? So I do feel like sometimes it's kind of that fine balance, because certain words are heavily loaded with a certain connotation. And if used, you actually end up alienating people, because they won't think about it necessarily. They just think that it doesn't concern them, when it might very well concern them, you know, especially this day and age where cancer is getting younger and younger now, right?
So what do you mean? Do you mean, like, if you want to talk about cancer, you'd rather not say, for example, cancer, and talk about, like, illness in a broader perspective, because you feel
like... No, I'm saying everyone should do whatever they want, right? And I think it's, that's what I'm saying, is that fine balance, because you do need the awareness. People need to be aware of breast cancer or testicular cancer or lung cancer or any of these things. Just like people need to be aware of the COVID symptoms, right? Like, when you're seeing these videos of people in hospital, from people our age saying, guys, like, this is not an easy ride. Like, I've been in the hospital for, like, a month and a half now, and I still can't walk without feeling tired. You need that level of awareness as well, right? So I don't think, again, I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's just that, you know, awareness is important, but I still feel like most people who are healthy don't necessarily, it doesn't resonate with them, is what I'm trying to say, right?
And what do you do? Like you've had some health challenges.
Yeah. So I had serious health challenges in 2018, where I also had to undergo treatment for about 8 months total.
So how did you like feel? I mean, you look like a healthy person. You know, you look like someone who's spiritual and takes care of her body and mind.
Yeah, and I know in my case, I mean, obviously initial shock, like anyone, and then it's just acceptance, pure acceptance. And I can say this now in retrospect, but like, I'm actually grateful that what happened because I don't think I would be where I am today had that not happened. I really see that episode in my life as like a kick in the butt. Like, get your act together, Sonia. You've like strayed away from your authentic self almost. And I had, I think, you know, like I got busy with the speaker circuit and like, you know, you get busy with life and work, etc. And I think I've just forgotten who I actually was, you know? And I think going through something like that kind of beautifully made me realign with who I actually am. It brought me back to my authentic self. It brought me back to the actual Sonia, not the, again, what we were talking about, the projected image of Sonia and the, you know, et cetera. And so it made me, it was 8 months where I did a lot of introspection. I wrote a lot. I tried to learn Arabic. I painted. I spent a lot of my friends came to visit me during that period. So I spent a lot of time rekindling relationships that people I hadn't seen even in years who came to see me. And so it was a beautiful episode. I definitely think I came out of it stronger and wiser. And I don't wish this on anyone, but for anyone who is facing health challenges, I think it's important to keep a positive mind, and a lot of the health challenge that you're going to face and whether or not you get out of it will be based on how you choose to deal with it. And the power is in your hands. And I can't stress this enough. I really believe in the power of mind over body. And yes, I did conventional stuff, but I also did alternative stuff. So I did acupuncture. I did a lot of sound healing. And I was so impressed with the effect that sound healing had on my body during my treatment, for example, that the year after my treatment, I actually became a certified sound healer myself.
What is sound healing?
So you see these bowls if you go to yoga studios or like meditation centers, etc. But this is like, so I have 7 bowls, for example, in my house. And like, if you were to come to my house, you would lie, super relaxing, by the way, for the person who's receiving it. You just lie on the floor. You don't have to do anything. You just lie there. And then I basically do kind of these, I put these bowls on different parts of your body to release certain parts of your bodies that might be blocked. And obviously, because like, if you put water in any of these bowls and you hit it, you'll see the droplets of water because of the sound coming out, right? You think that our bodies are made up of 65 to 70% of water. That's the effect that sound has on our body as well. And since then, I've become super hypersensitive to sound as well. Like, I'm super careful of what I choose to bring into my body as a sound, right? Like the type of music that I choose to listen to. Like, I'm very mindful, actually, of toxic noise, essentially.
So your first kick in the butt basically was your father's passing, and that kind of shook you, and you decided kind of to change course. And then 2018 with your health challenge was the second one. Do we need a kick in the butt to get moving?
If I look at these two kind of curveballs, essentially, the first one, I reacted very differently, obviously. Obviously, it's a question of maturity and age as well. But when I was 25 and dealing with this, I was in shock. I was actually dealt with it via escapism. So I asked work to give me more work. You know, I was going out with friends. I was not spending time with myself to actually address what had just happened. And instead, I was just trying to keep myself busy to not think about it. And what I found myself, interestingly, in 2018 is I ended up dealing with both curveballs that year. I finally accepted and dealt with my father's death, and I accepted and dealt with what I was going through as well. Yeah, so I think in a way, blessing in disguise, because I think I believe in epigenetics and I believe in emotions linked to your health, etc. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's just that we don't know about why we get sick, right? Like, even if you think about something like cancer, like, you know, we all have cancer cells in our body. Why is it that they're catalyzed in like my mom and not you, you know? Like, it's all these, we don't know. Like, doctors are very good at treating the symptoms. They don't know what originates, like how it originates.
So what would you say, I mean, having been through what you've been through, what would you say to someone who's feeling overwhelmed? You know, or who's dealing with pain, for example? Like, what's your advice?
I definitely, I mean, I based on my at least experience, what I felt worked was sitting with myself, not going out with friends and being busy or like watching Netflix or like whatever. Like, sit with yourself and listen to yourself. Like, what are you feeling? You know, like, ask yourself, how are you? How am I? And if you feel emotional and you feel like you need to cry because you're not doing well, then please cry. That release is so important. I feel like we don't cry enough as a society. And that's a physical release, right? So crying is actually really important. Let it go. Just cry. Cry yourself to sleep. Cry as much as you need to cry. Get it out, basically. So acceptance is, and that is part of the acceptance, I guess, stage in a way, right? You're accepting how you're feeling, you're accepting how it's affecting you, etc. And then once you feel comfortable accepting it and recognizing what's happening to you, think about how you're going to learn from this experience, right? So what are the, and this comes, it's easier to come for this to come kind of after the fact almost. But I think I was very mindful in 2018 about my daily learnings almost, right? Okay, so what did I learn today from going to my treatment? What did I learn today from going to my sound healing? What did I, you know, learn today from this difficult conversation I had with my partner at the time? So taking these kind of daily learnings, and you end up growing, like you really end up growing. It's really an acceleration of growth in a way. And that's why I say, like, I think regardless of what you believe in, God, the universe, energy, etc., it's happening for a reason. It really is happening for a reason, but it's up to you to understand why it's happening and what you can learn from it and how you're going to grow from it. Because you don't want to go back to square one after having gone through something like this, you know?
But it starts with you. As you said, you need to have that willingness to improve, or willingness to learn something from it. My last question to you, and I hear Sisu in the background.
I know! I'm sorry, my little one.
My last question to you. If I were to give you a magic wand, what's the one thing you would change in the world?
Wow. I think I would reignite empathy across all humans. I know it's in all of us, but many have forgotten that empathy and that altruism that we were talking about that's inside of us. We are all born as good people, but some of us just end up straying the wrong way. And I think if I had a magic wand, like the fairy godmother in Cinderella, where I'm like, empathy, that's what I would do.
I love that. Thank you so much, Sonia, for your time.
Thank you.
Lots of learning. Thanks a lot for sharing so openly.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. And thank you to the listeners and the viewers.
Yeah, and everyone who's listening, this is episode 7 of Conversations with Lulu. And I'd love your support. If you like the show, please subscribe. It's Conversation with Lulu on all the podcast players. And there's also Conversations with Lulu YouTube channel. And please share and tell your friends about it if you like it. And stay safe, everybody.